The worst is not that the Soviets are firing laser beams at us, but that the girls are out there fighting them. Not that a woman can't, but that she is. What does this do to the imagination, the heart, the soul of the next generation? What becomes of girls made by God in their nature to be their husbands' helpmates and to bear and raise their children, whose influence, stronger than the moons on the tide, attracts a man's rougher self to all the gentle, tender, soft, sweet, loving moments that can make love possible? First the husband and wife, then their children and their neighbors, and from thence to God, whose love is the natural law. John Sr.
So, Rowdy, how's it going, man? Welcome back.
Yeah, it's going good. It's going good. I had a pretty good week. I feel like every week's kind of just a normal week. There hasn't been any major things. We're finding out we're going to be able to move, which is pretty cool. We're going to be able to move closer to you guys, and that's going to be coming sooner than we thought, which is awesome. So that's exciting, getting to do that. Other than that, just a pretty normal week at work, and anniversary's coming up with my wife, so that'll be exciting. We have a pretty big weekend planned. Nothing crazy. Not trying to break the bank. Going good, though.
We're excited to have you all out here. Actually, we were talking about that the other day. We were sitting out by the fire pit the other night, looking up at the stars, and Lucia was running around, and we were saying, yeah, this would be a great time to have Rowdy and Marissa over if they lived right down the road instead of 30 minutes away.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't wait for those nights. I can't wait to have so many of those nights that we get sick of you guys.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It'll happen quick.
No.
So, yeah, I had a pretty good week as well. There's a nursery called the Bob Wells Nursery that sells tons of fruit trees, and I finally pulled the trigger on 2 apple trees. I've been thinking about this for years, thinking about the best variety. And then every year I kick myself that I don't just go ahead and plant one.
Well, yeah, because it's like a kind of a multi-generational commitment there before the tree really starts to bear true fruit.
Which... Yeah, like 5 years apparently. And I already have the peach trees and the plum trees.
I thought it was longer than 5 years.
It might be. We'll see. I guess, praying.
Yeah.
Everything's going well. Just a pretty normal week around here other than planting apple trees. So that was pretty good. This week we're having a little bit of a detour on our podcast. We were going to talk about Arabian Nights, but we misjudged the length of that book. Just how great of a book it is, yeah, lengthwise. And so we're going to take a break from that one. We want to mine that one for all the gold that it is. And
we had talked about, too, once we realized the length of the book, that we'll probably do this more often. So we hit those really long books, we may take a break from doing the book episodes. Then we'll just pull from John Sr.'s plethora of articles and knowledge and just thoughts. So as you heard in the opening, I read a quote from an article that he wrote for the Remnant newspaper that he contributed to a lot. And Caleb kind of turned me on to that, and he showed it to me, and he was like, man, I think we should do it over this. And I wholeheartedly agree. So what's the article about?
John Sr. wrote this in 1987, so kind of later in his life after he had already been a teacher. And I really was struck by it. I'm trying to read more of his articles, but was really struck by this article just because of how much truth it gives us about the world today that we're going through. So he kind of gives a layout, the plan of Marxism, and especially looking at Engels, who's kind of the cultural side of Marxism. A lot of people don't know that the Communist Manifesto was actually co-authored by Friedrich Engels as well as Karl Marx. But Engels is a lot more concerned with how to make these things happen culturally and not just how to make them happen economically.
That's really interesting because most people have heard of Marx because of Marxism, and it's kind of a buzzword these days. But it's kind of funny that most of the things that have entrenched themselves in our culture came from Engels, like the culture stuff. Because like Marx's economics, you know, young people like to hold on to them and they think they're great ideas and whatnot. But the ones that stuck around that people actually truly believe in these days, for better or for worse, mm-hmm, is from Engels. And you never hear about him. I didn't even know the guy's name until I read the article.
Yeah, right. He was the more influential, at least in our world today. John Sr. has a quote later on in this actual article where he says that the United States of America, as it is now, is further along in its communist tendencies culturally than even Russia. We've actually implemented a lot of the Marxist, a lot of the communist cultural ideas within the family, within the home, and now we're spreading those all over the world. It's not even Russia anymore who's pushing a lot of this agenda, but we've taken up that branch. It looks a little bit different because we call it capitalism and freedom and the ability to do whatever you'd like to do.
Yeah. And just as a reminder, John Senior wrote this in the 80s, early 80s. It's almost, I mean, the sexual revolution was fully underway. It had already happened. So it's not super prophetic, but to think about he was writing this in the 80s and what he would see today, it's kind of like, oh man.
Yeah.
It kind of was a little prophetic from Senior.
Yep. We'll get into parts that make him, he couldn't even imagine what was coming forward in certain aspects, but even though he didn't know what was coming with in terms of like transgenderism, but he talks not directly about that, but mentions it implicitly, I guess, or not explicitly, but.
Yeah. So the article starts out, the first couple paragraphs, or I'd probably say the first fifth of the article, is him kind of laying out the groundwork for what he's about to kind of go against or defend or make an argument for. And so he lays out that the basics of Marxism and Engels and Marxist thought was about the family, that we were hunter-gatherers to begin with, and that we, monogamous man and a woman relationship forever, that whole idea came about pretty late, and it was kind of an invention of man and the patriarchy to get control and to seize control from the women, because from the theory that he got from some of the anthropologists was that the man just went out and hunted and gathered, and they pretty much slept with whoever they wanted to, had all these kids, and the father had no rights to tell anybody what to do because he didn't know who was who, and he didn't know who to give his power to when he left. Like, the chief of the tribe didn't know that. The mother did. The mother knew, and so the mothers had the political power. That was the theory. And then as soon as we started doing crops instead of hunting and gathering, and we started to commercialize, produce them intentionally, the men supposedly seized control. And that's when you have the beginning of the nuclear family.
This is kind of the pseudoscience that revolves around Engels' hypothesis. That is his ultimate goal, is that we once again return to this community living where there is no longer marriage or monogamy or really even children being raised by family members, but rather everybody just lives in community. People are able to sleep with whoever they want and do whatever they want. Now, it's more sophisticated than that in Marxism. I mean, there's a whole economic structure, but that's the ultimate goal. That's what they looked at as the Garden of Eden. And once again, we're saying it's pseudoscience because he's talking about a period that would exist long before the Bible. He's using conjecture to assume that this is what would happen because the anthropologist that he was listening to at the time had lived with the Native American people for a little bit, and they had a similar structure. That's the first stage of human life. And then there was the first revolution, which Rowdy talked about, when man begins domesticating animals, growing livestock, and becomes a farmer. And then the second stage, in which the lady will get together with a man for a year, so he will at least know who his children are. So that's kind of the second stage. The third revolution, by Engels, hasn't been realized yet, or at least he doesn't say that it has been, and that's where marriage no longer exists at all, essentially.
Yeah, and I mean, some of that stuff you're saying kind of sounds hyperbolic. They just want it to where you can sleep with whoever you want, do whatever you want, and it seems like we're strawmanning the Marxist position. But I'm just going to read something here that lays it out what the goal is for women. This is Engels' words. Then it will be plain that the first condition for the liberation of the wife is to bring the whole female sex back into public industry, and that this, in turn, demands that the characteristic of the monogamous family as the economic unit of society be abolished. Just plain and clear that the whole goal of this cultural revolution that he's proposing is to abolish the monogamous family in general, and people can just do whatever they want. The state raises your kids.
Yep, that's the whole building block of society. This is what he predicted. With the transfer of the means of production into common ownership, the single family ceases to be an economic unit of society. Private housekeeping is transformed into a social industry. The care of children and education becomes a public affair. Society looks after all children alike, whether they are legitimate or not. This removes all the anxiety about the consequences. And by that, Senior says, Engels means pregnancy here, which today is the most essential factor that prevents a girl from giving herself completely to the man that she loves. And here, Senior, of course, says that he means the number of men that she wants to sleep with.
And he does that caveat a couple times throughout the article of when he talks about love here, It's a surface kind of love. It's not a deep, sacrificial, sacramental love. It's more of just like, hey, I have some, you know, I have some feelings for you. You're attractive. We should, you know, we should hook up, right? That's the kind of love that he's talking about. You can see that because the consequences of that love is a child. And so it can't be a very deep love if they haven't thought about children or they're not thinking about that next step. It's just, hey, I like you. I'm attracted to you. Let's do this.
That's what Ingalls says that love is. If only the marriage based on love is moral, and that's what he's positing, then also only the marriage is moral in which love continues. But the intense emotion of individual love varies very much in duration from one individual to another, especially among young men. And if affection comes to an end or is supplanted by a new passionate love, then separation is a benefit for both partners as well as for society. Only people will then be spared having to wade through the useless mire of a divorce court. And so he's saying we shouldn't get married at all because love doesn't even last. Yeah. And men are fickle and women are fickle.
Yeah.
And so they always want to meet another person or have another fling or have another fire outside of their marriage bond. And that's the only sort of thing that's moral for them to do is to engage in that morality. Ingalls was a degenerate. I mean, very clearly what he's pushing for is just for women to be able to sleep with whoever they want without any consequence and men to be able to do the same.
There's no control of your passions. I was listening to someone talk just today about how much more virtuous is it to be a man in this world and to have complete control of your passions and your desires and to promote chastity and to promote chivalry and really pursue that sacrificial love and not just be someone consumed by your passions. The party life and the hookup life, it's all driven by our desires and our passions. There's no control over that. As soon as we feel a certain way, we just give into it. We give into the temptation.
That's the problem with a lot of these influencers. They've never learned how to be men. They've never learned that the most important thing to do with your life is to live an ordinary life, to love one woman till her death,
yeah,
to have kids, to raise them up in the way that they ought to go. They haven't learned any of that. And yet they're the most influential. But I think they're influential because our society is so broken. We've definitely gone down this path, but there's a reason why men are looking for that.
Yeah.
And men have been told their whole lives of our generation that no, women are the same as you. They can do anything that you can do, but better. So he lays it out very clearly on what the whole goal is and how we get there. And the way that we get there is by women entering the socially productive workforce, being lifted of the duties, the most important duties they have, which is the raising of children, in which he says that the state will just raise the kids so that we'll no longer have to worry about that aspect. Rather, we would put the ladies into the socially productive workforce. And this is certainly an area which has very successfully succeeded in our lifetime. It's very uncommon for women not to work. Mostly what they do is work.
That's what's super sad about this whole movement. It has this overlay of just wanting women to be equal, have equal rights as men. But the vision for that is to make women men. It's not to lift up the women in the beauty of their femininity. It's we need to make you as close to men as possible. And so it's honestly against women. And that gets covered by this sheen of women empowerment. We want you to go and do these things and be these people and have the career and make all the money and all that. And it's just covering up the fact that we're just trying to diminish the female.
Yeah. And it begs the question of what does it mean to be a woman? What does it mean to have a good life? We're trying to make them to be like men, which no man wants. No man wants a masculine woman. No man wants an overbearing woman. I've never met a man that wants that. If you look at the men who get married young, like me and Rowdy, they're very feminine women. They're traditional women, because that's what men want. They want a woman who's going to be a good mom, who's going to raise a bunch of kids, who's going to love us more than anything else.
What's even sad about that is, even as you say that, there's something inside of me that balks at it. That, oh, you just want women to stay home? You want them to stay home with the kids all day and do that? Because our culture has just
brainwashed us.
Yeah, that's a bad thing. You shouldn't stay home. That's a prison. Raise kids. Like, he's just keeping you there and he's going out with all his boys and hanging out. And like, that's all that's going through my mind because that's all I grew up with.
The crazy thing about it is that's revolutionary. That is the revolution. Now, in order to say what has always been said in the history of mankind, of Western civilization, the normal thing, that two people become one flesh, they're no longer two but one, that they aren't the same, that they have different jobs, different duties, different responsibilities, different inclinations that they both fulfill, that the man is the head of the family, that the woman is submissive to him. These things are radical to say, but they're really not. The whole purpose of this revolution that Engels is talking about is he's really trying to fight a battle. And the battle against Marxism, against communism, against this thought, John Sr. says, is no longer being fought with guns or bullets, with soldiers, but is being fought in the home. And is being fought with woman against her husband and a husband against his wife. And we see this all the way back in Genesis. That's one of the curses of Eve, that her desire will be for her husband and he'll rule over her. From now on, woman's desire will be the head of the household, to be like a man, to be her husband, to be the one who makes the decisions. And he will rule it over her. He was created to be the leader of the family. Now, the war is no longer fought with bullets and sending guys over to Russia in war, although we're fighting a proxy war with Russia right now. And we're probably on opposite sides because we're pushing a lot of the cultural stuff in Russia and abroad that Engels was talking about. John Sr. says that this war is one like we've never seen in history. We lost the war in Vietnam, not only in the jungles and then the universities and in the demonstrations and all that, but quietly in the family, which was weakened to the point where a whole generation was destroyed. How can you win a war abroad if you lose it in the home?
Yeah.
And we've already lost it in the home.
Yeah.
But it's wonderful because the home is also where you regain the war, where you reverse this cultural Marxism and, quite frankly, feminism.
Yeah, and it's something that he kind of alludes in the article is the woman's right to vote and how it seems like, well, of course, women are just as smart as men. We have the same reasoning powers. Why would they not be able to vote? The thing you brought up was that we used to vote as a family. And that's what's huge is that the family is the unit of society. That's a big thing that Senior kind of gets at is that it is a singular unit of society. They should be the same team. And so the husband and wife in the family should agree who to vote. Ultimately, it's the father's decision. That can be a burden as much as a privilege.
Yep.
He's the one who makes the final call and makes the decision and does the, you know, this could be for several things, but in this case, the voting.
That still happens in traditional families a lot. You might not notice it, but we had Super Tuesday yesterday, and what was the first thing that my wife did was ask me who she should vote for. So even now, her vote is still just my vote. And if it's not that, you have a war within the family. That's what John Sr. says.
Yeah. There's division in the family.
The first step in the process has already begun in Engels' day with the suffragette movement, which broke the unity of families and weakened the position of men as heads of the household by giving women separate votes, converting the discourse between husband and wife from conversation to debate, preparing the way for what has happened in our time when women have entered what Engels called the socially productive workforce, competing for jobs against men and driving the price of labor down so low that you have to have a two-income household in order to meet the family budget. And so, yeah, it's not bad that women have the right to vote, but the argument against it is that men and women are one when you're married. You're one flesh. You're no longer two. You're one flesh. So how do you separate that in half? A house divided against itself cannot stand. So what happens when a wife is really involved in politics and she votes for somebody else? What does that do? I can't imagine the marital strife.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff that breaks apart families.
Well, there's a whole value structure that would just be in conflict all the time.
You'd be unequally yoked.
And this also sounds like we're jumping on the woman's part in this. This is a little a shot at men too, because this is a responsibility, not necessarily always a privilege. It's a responsibility that men need to take seriously. We need to sacrifice ourselves for our families.
We have the responsibility and the culpability.
Yeah.
Ultimately, since the husband is the head of the household, the head of the family, we are primarily responsible for the education of our kids, the feeding of our kids, the housework gets done. Everything is the responsibility of the man. He's the head of the household. Everything comes back to him. He's culpable for all of it. The way that the family votes, the politicians that they'll put into place, who will be responsible in a minor way for how their children are able to be raised. That's a big responsibility that men have. That's the beauty of a marriage, because women, right, my wife understands that. She's like, I'm so glad I don't have to make all the decisions. Really, the saddest part about all of this, we have done even the second stage that Ingalls talks about with the year-long marriages just to know who the dad is. So many people are divorced so fast and have multiple different spouses, some 7 or 8 different marriages. And in practice, that is this. They don't understand what marriage is, ultimately. It's the saddest thing, but they're living that out. You see nowadays women acting like men. And by that, I mean the worst forms of men. Because they are throwing their body and selling them online and sleeping with whoever they want without any sort of qualm socially or morally. They act as if it's okay. All you got to do is watch the Whatever podcast.
That's a sad thing to behold sometimes, is the tragedy of our culture and the tragedy of our young men and young women who just, they feel the need that this is the way. This is what it means to live a good life, to live a happy life. Just to see how that road doesn't end well.
And why is it sad? Is because marriage is such a beautiful thing. But it's beautiful in the same sense that a symphony is beautiful. There's different instruments all playing their part. There's harmony. If anyone is out of step, it's just a train wreck. If a woman tries to be a man, and you see this a lot with domineering wives, and their marriages fall apart. It's the saddest thing to see a domineering woman push a husband to the point where finally he'll divorce her over the years because he can't step it up and be a man and to take up his authority. It's a terrible thing to watch. It's sad because neither of them are able to fulfill the plan that God has for them. God's given the husband the grace to be the husband, to be the head of the household, to lead the family, to love his wife so much that he will lay down his life for her. And the wife has been given the grace in order to be submissive to her husband and to love him. And she'll find freedom in that and joy in that and peace in that. And when they try to flip it, it's like a bull trying to be a cow. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, he says that in the article. One example kind of off of your symphony, Marissa and I and her family went and watched The Nutcracker. And one thing I saw was, you know, you have male and female ballet performers. And one thing that's kind of incredible to see is that the male performers are obviously stronger. They jump higher. They can do crazier stuff. But the women are just majestic. And so during the ballet, you see these gender roles played out in a ballet of how the man lifts the woman up and he showcases her beauty and he brings out the beauty of the woman and he supports her and he lays down his self under her, and kind of seeing that the correct gender role dynamic play out in something like a ballet. That was kind of something profound from watching The Nutcracker. And I think it's an important image that we should really think about.
That's natural. That's the way it's always been and the way it's supposed to be. I used to always balk at the phrase, and I still do. I hate this so much, this phrase. And I always say the same thing. I've never seen a happy marriage where the husband has ever told me, oh, happy wife, happy life. Every time I hear that, I'm like, sounds like a miserable marriage to me. To me, what that says is, I'm going to let the wife run all over me, do whatever she wants. She won't truly be happy, because what she ultimately wants is for her husband to be the husband and stand up and be the leader of the family, spiritually, financially, all those things. And yet he's not doing his duty, but he's going to say, happy wife, happy life.
When you see that phrase, happy wife, happy life, it's true of itself, but the way it's used is like, man, just do whatever she says. Do whatever she says, make her happy, and do whatever it takes to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain extent, that's true. We should sacrifice to make our family happy. But our wives, they're not a petulant children that just need to be satisfied so they stop crying.
Exactly.
That's a disrespect to a woman's dignity. She's a woman and she's an adult and she should be able to take criticism, just like we as men should take criticism. We're just treating them like children by just saying, just put a pacifier. Give her a bottle of milk. Just do whatever, you know.
Yep.
Just satisfy her. So
happy
I don't
wife,
have to,
happy life.
Yeah, yep. So I don't have to hear the nagging.
And the truth is, your wife will find way more happiness if you're a traditional husband who loves her. And that's what Ingalls has forgotten in all this. He makes marriage look like a transaction. He talks about marriage the way people talk about prostitutes. But it's not that at all. Marriage is a thing that a man will want to give his whole life for. And he should. He will give up his life for his wife. He should love her as Christ loved the church. And that's ultimately what happens in a good marriage. And so it's not tyranny. It's not the husband saying, you can't do this or that. That conversation is never had. It's an understanding that the husband is the head of the household. And there's a dance happening between two people who aren't two powerful beings standing in the room fighting against each other. If this isn't an MMA fight, this is a waltz.
Yeah.
This is a beautiful dance.
The ballet.
This is a ballet. And each person has their role to play. And once you realize that, come into that, understand that, there's so much more peace and harmony in the marriage. And if you never find that, there will never be peace in the marriage. If the woman is always acting like a man, there'll never be peace in the marriage. My wife has this phrase, feminine men make masculine women. And feminine women make masculine men. And that's true. If your wife is feminine, you will take up that mode to be masculine. And the opposite is true. It's a beautiful dance.
Yeah.
It's love. It's not talked about. The husband doesn't go, hey, I'm your boss. And that's not it at all.
And
the husband's writing his wife poetry.
Yeah.
Singing her love songs.
Yeah, which we'll get to later on in this, in the article, where he talks about what does that look like when we go through the virtues. And I mean, Caleb and I have talked about the podcast. We don't want it to be overtly Christian, you know, preach at whoever's listening. A really good example of the idea of this is really to look at Ephesians and to see that the man needs to be like Christ and the woman is like the church. And really kind of dig in deep to that of Christ was ahead and obviously Christ was God. And we're not saying that men should be God, but we're saying, what did Christ go do? He sacrificed everything. He gave his whole self, everything he had, for the salvation of the ones that he loved. That's what being the head of the household should mean. It shouldn't mean that, oh yeah, I have all the power now. No, it's sacrificial love. Laying down yourself day in and day out. Not necessarily a physical death, but a death every day. Doing things that you don't necessarily want to do every day, but it's for the betterment of yourself and your family. And then the woman, their role is like the church. They need to nurture the people, and the people being your children, and even to a certain extent, the husband. They need to nurture the husband in the home, and it needs to be a safe haven where they can grow in virtue and they can grow in wisdom and find their love there. And that love is going to bloom, like he said in the opening quote, it's going to bloom so many different virtues that's just going to bleed out into everyone around you, your friends, your family, your neighbors, and eventually into society.
That's really the beauty of marriage. When I say feminism, I mean cultural communism. When I say Marxism, I mean cultural communism. That's what we're talking about right now. We're talking about Ingalls' thought. And that is where the feminist movement comes from at the very beginning, even first wave feminists at the very beginning, as John Senior was just talking about. In society, it's not just that a woman should work, it's that she must work. It's not an option for her not to work. Women who stay at home are berated by their peers. Why would you do that? Why would you choose to stay home? Oh, can't you do anything else?
Yeah.
You just sit around at the house all day? And it's the craziest thing, because society would much rather have a woman working for some man and obeying him instead of listening to her husband and working for the most important things. Women's work is way more important than men's work will ever be.
Yeah.
It is far superior to what men can ever do.
Yeah.
Our aptitude is to originally go out into the field, put our hands in the dirt, bring the crops in, bring the bacon in, nowadays make money to feed the family. And a woman's job is to love her kids, to raise them to be the kind of people that they should be one day,
yeah,
to teach them why life is beautiful, why it's worth living. To love them in a way that no other person can love them.
Yeah.
Nobody can love you like your mom.
Mm.
And yet, in our society, what do we say? Oh, go work for some man. Listen to him. Let him be your boss. But don't listen to your husband ever. And farm your kids out to whatever random stranger you want. They might take care of them. They'll never love your kids like you do. It's impossible for them. It's impossible for them to do the job of mom. And that's the most important job. There's no more important job on the planet. And yet in our society, we just praise the girl bosses. We praise it when girls do something that's so insignificant. If they were to die on the job, they'd be replaced 5 minutes later. It's just a job. The only job you can never be replaced from is mom. And yet so many women choose to go out there and work.
It's reflected in our culture, in our music, in our movies especially. The girl boss. And a good example of what we're saying here of the culture just wanting women to be men is you look at like Marvel, the girl superheroes. And is that inherently bad? No. But every girl superhero is just a female version of a man. They're super strong. They hit the bad guys in the face. They don't uplift feminine power of nurturing and caring and love. You know, and that's not to say that women can't be strong, because we're not saying that women and men should be cookie cutter versions of each other. There's give and take between your individual personality traits. What we're saying is that there's a role, there's a mantle to be taken up and to do the job. And so what you see in Hollywood, they're just men. They're just men in wigs. Superheroes that look like women, and it's just dudes. That sounds crass and a little bit hyperbolic, but it's true. We don't see true femininity really showcased in movies. Like the loving mother who really is the glue of the family, holding a family together and raising good kids. You don't see that in movies anymore.
Because it's not sexy and it doesn't yeah. sell. But you know, there's nothing more beautiful in life than an ordinary husband and his ordinary wife and their ordinary kids. That's a play on a G.K. Chesterton quote.
The ordinary is more extraordinary than the extraordinary.
Yeah.
The ordinary is way more extraordinary than the extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds super paradoxical, but true.
It's true, especially in our day and age where women are men. Literally, some of them are actually trying to be men because they don't know how to be women because they've never seen femininity portrayed correctly. Their moms weren't at home teaching their kids, loving their kids. It's so sad to me to see daycare, honestly. It's the saddest thing to drive by daycare and you see 30 kids out there
yeah.
and three teachers and just to know that none of them love them, or at least not the way the mom does.
It's kind of a superficial love. They care for the kids. They care about their well-being, but it's not the love of a mother. If you stop paying the daycare, they're not going to love your kids too much anymore, exactly. right?
Yeah, never love them, never nourish them the way that the mom does. And the reason we're talking so harshly on this is because this is a big experiment that we're in right now. We're living in the first society who has taken the moms out of the homes. And we're dealing with the ramifications, which is higher suicide rates, more and more murder, nonstop divorce rates, and going, guys, let's give something else a try. Kids these days don't even know if they're a boy or a girl. They don't even know the most basic facts about human life. What the heck are we doing as a society? Let's give the experiment up. How about we do the tried and true thing that's always been real and has always worked? Give it a try, and it's beautiful. The house isn't a tyranny. The house is the place you should want to go home. But men are the reason that the house is a tyranny, and this is what John Sr. talks about as well. He does a rebuke of capitalism in the same article. Because he says that we're so consumed with money, we're so consumed with getting capital, that to men, children are just a liability. Children have always been an addition. They've never been a liability for families. Families used to have as many kids as they possibly could so that they could help them on the farm. That's why men used to get paid a dowry for their daughters, which isn't something that we should bring back. But... But the whole reason why was because that's how valuable women were. That them getting married was a big loss for the family. Because of who they were, what they did, and the love that was in the home. So it was a big loss yeah. for the family. So kids weren't this, you know, I'm ready to get them off the paycheck. Need to get them married off and out of the house to some other guy. No, it wasn't that. It was I love for them to be here. I want them to be here. They're such a big help to me.
One thing that he gets to in the article here up on that topic is, here's just a quote, I'm just going to read it. It says, when private property is taken as the end of human life, as it often is among us, and not as a means to an end of a good human life, it is true then that no one's place is in the home. If everything is measured by money, marriage really is a legal cloak for prostitution, as Marx and Engels said. There's a certain kind of man who thinks that the acquisition of property is the purpose of his life. He doesn't buy a house because he wants a home, but an investment. And if he pushes that view further, he will look upon his wife as an investment too, and children as unnecessary expenses, which he prevents. He's knocking the culture and the women trying to be men, but he's also knocking men. If you're chasing the money, no. Go home and love your family.
If you're a tyrant to your wife, she's not going to want to be there.
No.
She's not going to want to stay at home. She's not going to want to have more of your kids. She's not going to want to love you fully with her whole heart. And that's the difference. Submission with your wife isn't tyranny. John Sr. says it's not tyranny. It's what the love that's talked about in the Song of Psalms, which is what St. Thomas Aquinas said was the climax of the Bible. It's the love story that we have between us and God, but it's also the love story that we have between us and our spouses. And some of these phrases are almost so indecent to even read them at Mass. Yeah. Like, I don't know about you, when you go to a wedding Mass and somebody reads from the Song of Songs, it's like, my wife, you know, my beloved is a beautiful gazelle, and I look out the window at him prancing through the woods, and I always feel a little uncomfortable. I'm like, ooh, this is a little bit too risque for Mass. But that's in the Bible, because that's the kind of love that we ought to have with our spouses. It's not tyranny.
Yeah.
It's never talked about. The husband isn't sitting there fighting with his wife over who's the man, because he's the man.
I was actually talking to a friend today about Mary and Mary's yes, and kind of with the Holy Spirit coming upon her, what that meant, and how it's so hard to talk about that with the intimate language in our over-sexualized, pornified culture. How to talk about the Holy Spirit conceived in Mary, the Son of God. So are we talking like Zeus coming down with the women? No. We're not talking about that. This is something even more intimate than that. And it's not meant to be sexual in the way that our culture is using that term. It's so hard to read those passages, like in the Song of Songs, and to read some commentary about God's role in him coming into us and how that sounds. And it's hard to really realize what that means truly. Till you get married and you realize what becoming one flesh means. It's not just the fun part, right? becoming one flesh means so much. By us coming together and becoming one flesh, we bring forth life. Ultimately, God brings forth the life, but by us coming together, new life is created.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's marriage. It's beauty. It's a dance. It's a symphony. It's husbands thinking about their wives all day when they're at work, wishing that they were at home with them.
Yeah.
It's husbands writing poetry to their wives. It's husbands singing a song to their beloved. It's the stuff that's in the operas. It's the stuff that the sonnets are written about. It's not lust. It's true love. It's deep. It's lasting. It endures forever. It's not a battle over who is going to be the man in the relationship and who's going to be the woman. If that's a battle, there's a problem. There is no battle because we live in truth about who we are. And you can't change the fundamental truths of man. The man will always be the man. The woman will always be the woman. They must play this part, this role. And if they do that, they'll be happy and they'll live a happy life. John Sr. goes on to talk in this article because the ultimate attack by Engels is an attack on the family. And that's the attack that we've seen be successful for the cultural communist and the feminist in our society. That's why we're further along in communism than the Russians are. Because a lot of the things that we're pushing, Russia would never push. No-fault divorce, so-called gay marriage, transgenderism. That's what the West is pushing now. Cultural Marxism. When men forget how to be men, and women think that they are men, we've forgotten the basics of society. So we're further along into communism than even Russia is. But he gives us a list of things that we can do to work on our marriages, to make marriage grow. If Ingalls is the roadmap to this cultural revolution, then St. Paul, the Gospels, and the virtues are how we regain love, are how we become, once again, friends with our spouse, which is what we ought to be. Yeah. We ought to actually love our spouse more than we love our kids. We should think about our spouse, long for our spouse way more than we long to see our kids because we're one with them. And if we don't, something's disordered. This is a text from Galatians 5. But if you would live by the Spirit, you are not under the law. Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are fornication, uncleanness, immodesty, luxury, idolatry, witchcraft, enmities, contentions, wraths, quarrels, dissensions, sex, envies, murders, robberies, and such like, of which I foretell you as I have foretold you. They who do such things shall not obtain the kingdom of God. The fruit of the Spirit is charity, joy, peace, patience, benignity, goodness, longanimity, mildness, faith, modesty, continence, and chastity. So this is our roadmap. And John Sr. will put these into a slightly different order, and he'll say that these build upon each other like a stairway. That's the way the spiritual masters always talk about the spiritual life, is this ladder by which we go up to God, this ladder of humility with these different steps. And John Sr. gives us that for marriage. And so the first one for marriage is actually chastity. And he says, this is the virtue by which we withdraw ourselves from all unlawful desire. By exercising the supernatural habit of chastity, we take the first real step immediately accessible to us up the staircase towards charity. This word is interesting because a lot of people think it means, oh, well, obviously continence, which means that you have no sexual relations. And that's not chastity at all. Chastity means that you have rightly ordered acts.
Yeah. The resistance to all unlawful desires, as St. Thomas says it, how he quotes it in here, that opens it up. Because like you said, when I hear chastity, you know, you always think about, you know, chastity talks or saving sex till marriage or abstinence and all that. But it's so much more than that. It can be the unlawful desire to drink too much, the unlawful desire towards pride, all that. And to having chastity in those senses and to fight those battles, that's just the first step.
Yeah, very concretely. The next step up the rung, so the first step is chastity. The second step is continence, which St. Thomas says is freedom from desire for even good and lawful, but unnecessary things. This is the one of the most difficult things in our society because we're so materialistic in a way that we've never been before. Because man lived pretty much the same way for 1900 years without any change at all. I mean, what could you really desire? We didn't have air conditioning. We didn't have iPads. We didn't have maybe more land. Maybe your neighbor's wife. Maybe your neighbor had a really cool cow. You know, maybe it looked nice. That might be what you wanted.
Yeah, we've lost the ability to feast because every day's a feast. We have everything we could ever need and want almost every day. And so we've lost that ability to feast well. And so continence is huge. Because that's the ability to say no to things when we don't need them. To say no to that extra donut. The ability to say no to that gluttonous desire to just have more and more and more just because you want more.
And to not even have the desire for it.
And the donut's not necessarily bad, but it's not really good for you either. And having the ability to say no to that is huge.
And this leads to happiness, as St. Thomas says, and also Edmund Burke said that philosophical happiness is to want less, not to have more. And St. Thomas says, the theological happiness is to want absolutely nothing but what God wants. And so we should not want, but we're bombarded with wants. And we're so unhappy as a society.
It's so obvious, even in our broken culture, that riches don't give you what you need. Any rich person or famous person will probably tell you up front, grass isn't always greener on this side. Life's still hard. Even when I have everything I could ever want, life's still hard.
And the difference is you can have everything you want money-wise, and yet you could have missed out on the entire lives of your kids because you decided to work instead. And the love of your kids that one day won't take care of you in the nursing home because you didn't really take care of them. They won't want you to be in their home because you didn't show them the example of how to do that. You weren't willing to die to yourself. And so they won't die for you.
The next up, modesty. I found this section pretty fascinating because like chastity, you think of modesty primarily for women. You need to be modest in the way you dress. Don't show too much. You know, cover the ankles. Don't let me see an ankle or a shoulder. But he goes into it here that it's not just the way we dress, men or women. It's the way we talk. It's the way we act and how we should do those things and do the right thing in the right situation.
Doing the right thing in the right situation as decorum demands. And it's a respect thing. It's respect for the other people who are there. So it would be improper to wear shorts as a man to visit the King of England. That would be super improper. It'd be improper to wear shorts to go to mass or jeans because the King of the universe is here. And so it's immodest for a man to show up to mass as if this is just his normal life and not understand that someone far greater than he, far greater than the king, far greater than the president. He might not even like the president. But if he was to meet the president, I guarantee you he would dress up.
Yeah.
Because it's the office that matters. And that's the decorum that's correct.
Yeah.
He might not even like the current pope. But I guarantee he would dress up to meet the pope.
Absolutely.
We don't have respect for each other in our daily life. So modesty is hard for us. We're so immodest as a culture, and it's especially women. And I'll say this, men are really immodest. What we wear to the grocery store, the kind of respect we have towards other people, what we wear to mass. But also there's this talking point that a lot of women have. Oh, well, he just shouldn't look at my body. With women who just don't respect anybody.
Yeah.
They don't respect their body. They don't respect men on the street or women on the street. Who it might cause to fall into sin, who might look at that lustfully and remember that later that night. They don't have any concern that that might happen. They don't have any respect for the people who are around them.
They don't realize the burden that that puts on men. Yes, there's virtue to be had for men to have custody of the eyes, and even if someone is dressed poorly, to not do that. That's part of the man's fault, but women aren't devoid of that responsibility either. You shouldn't dress in a way where you want men to look at you. What I was saying is that women, they want men to love them for who they really are, but then our culture wants them to dress the way they dress and to only see the superficial bodily image of themselves. That's not who they are, but that's who they're giving to the world for all the men to see.
And both of our wives are very modest. Thank you, Lord, for that. We didn't have to have that fight. Once again, you just marry a good woman and you don't worry about it. But I've told my wife many times, she's so beautiful, she doesn't need makeup.
Yeah.
And it's true. There's no reason why my wife should wear makeup. I don't want my daughter feeling like she should have to wear makeup. I don't want my daughter seeing my wife putting on makeup. Because I'm like, no, you're perfect the way you are. There's nothing in society that would make me feel like I need to put on makeup as a man.
Yeah.
It's just a societal concern for women. Yeah. And every time she's doing it, it just makes me think of that. It's so sad that women don't think that they're beautiful enough to live life without it.
I'm glad you think the same way, because I 100% agree with the makeup thing. I think makeup is ridiculous, and I hate that it was invented that our wives and our women feel like they need to put on makeup to be beautiful. Because like you said, women are beautiful, and it's just a shame that they have to cover that up. And the way my wife sees it, and it's hard for me to see this because I'm not a woman, would be that it makes her feel beautiful. And that's just a shame that she has to do that to feel beautiful. And I pray that I have the virtue to make her actually feel truly beautiful and not some powder that she throws on her face.
Yeah, I think if our wives saw themselves through our eyes, they would know how beautiful we find them. And hopefully they wouldn't just swore it off altogether.
Yeah.
But I know that there's just this doubt and that society puts in their mind.
Yeah.
That you're not beautiful unless you wear makeup. And I'm like, if you saw yourself the way I see you,
yeah,
you would know how much I love you and how you don't need any of that junk on your face. But you're perfect just the way that you are.
And Marissa and I have talked about the makeup thing because, you know, she still wears makeup, and we've talked about our kids and how we want to introduce that to them. Because, I mean, if you just don't do it at all and then they're introduced when they're in college, it's like, that's probably not the best. And so the way I kind of tell her how I would like it to be is that I feel like makeup, earrings, jewelry, what you wear, it should be more of an accent to your beauty. It shouldn't cover up anything. It should enhance what's already there, if you do anything at all. But so much of it today is, oh, I got a pimple, I got to cover that up.
Or contour.
Yeah. Yeah, make you have some jaw.
Make it look like you have a strong right? jaw.
And it's such a shame that our women of today need that.
That's exactly right. So that's modesty.
I didn't want to read this because he didn't talk about modesty toward others only. It was modesty toward self as well. And so this quote at the end of this little section says, modesty means tact and tone toward self, demanding neither too much nor too little of yourself, not to make your piety a burden to yourself and to your friend, but doing all with cheer, cherishing fruits, not swallowing pills of the Holy Ghost.
That's right.
I just found that super interesting of the whole not swallowing pills, but cherishing the fruits. And that's almost more of like knowing yourself. Don't make your own piety a burden to your friend. Be modest in the sense that you have dignity. You're wearing pants to mass because that's the right thing to do. You're not selling yourself short.
I love that phrase because it's really what we've been talking about this whole time. Women and men, when they love each other, when they're living in a rightly ordered marriage, it's not like you're swallowing a hard pill. Oh, my husband's gonna, you know, I've got to be submissive to him. It's that the wife loves the husband so much that she's naturally submissive to him. And he loves her so much. So I love this quote after these three. So these are the building blocks. The first one is chastity. The second one is
continence.
And the third one was modesty. And John Sr. said, husbands and wives, if every single day you would take a single one of these habits and practice it the way you would a sport or a musical instrument, think what progress we would make in the interior life. Think what modesty could do in just a day. If husband and wife would think of each other as the mode or note of the Gregorian chant, to make that person the attractive point of all one's words and actions all day long, to make the day's activities a melody that finds its rest in him or her.
How beautiful is that last sentence? I absolutely love it. To make that person the attractive point of all one's words and actions all day long, to make the day's activities a melody that finds its rest in him or her.
And that's what happens in a beautiful marriage.
And that just goes to show that what we're talking about here, once again, is not the tyrant husband. It's to make the day's activities a melody that finds its rest in him or her. All of our words and all of our actions, like he says here, should be pointed towards serving the other in our respective roles. And I just think that's a beautiful image of a marriage and how it should be, and using these virtues for that.
In our culture, we've forgotten this, and so it sounds strange. We balk at it. I balk at it. Society hasn't always been like this. We're living in an age of revolution. Philosophy matters and changes people's concrete lives.
Yeah.
This plague has entered our society. It has reached every aspect of our society. It's reached every single marriage. And so it has impacted us whether or not people have ever heard the name of Marx or Engels. Whether they know his philosophy or not, this has affected you in your life. This has affected me. And so we had to get rid of a lot of the ideas of how a marriage would look when we came into it. We had to completely break the idea that our life was going to be about making as much money as we could.
Yeah.
Because you can't take it with you when you go. And it's never going to make you happy. And you can search your whole life for the happiness. And you can be depressed your whole life, having millions of dollars and never having found it. But that's your choice.
Yeah.
You just went along the same road everybody else did.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you were luckier. Maybe you got more money. Maybe that wasn't luck. My wife is such a beautiful example of a mom that Lucia, our oldest daughter, actually now wants to feed the baby doll. And she always says, feed the baby doll. And we didn't notice what she was doing for a couple months because, you know, sometimes she would just like cover her head and have her baby doll under there. And so one day she pulls her shirt up and puts the baby doll. She thought she was feeding the baby doll.
Oh my goodness.
And I thought, you know, how beautiful. Yeah. This is the way it should be. She's learning how to be a mom. Mm-hmm. And my wife learned that from her mother as well. And a lot of it because she was home with her for the first 3 years of her life. She learned a lot of that implicitly. And parents don't realize that. We learn how to be human beings, especially that first 5 years of our life. That's where we learn how to deal with our emotions, where we learn the empathy from our moms. That's where a lot of our life is set into motion. And it's a problem when you just outsource it to the nearest daycare down the road. Because then the kids grow up with their ideals.
And they're being the institution that's doing the teaching or doing the caring. You outsource all that child care to someone else. And he talks about that earlier in the article about the state should raise your kids. You should just let the state do it, right? Whoever's in power just gets complete control.
And we see that nowadays. Preschool is getting younger and younger and younger, and that's being pushed on the ballot. And it's so sad to me when I see parents who are so excited for it. Oh, great. Y'all can take them at three? There's nothing sadder to me than that.
Than the child being treated as a burden.
Yeah. It makes me look at the parents and go, do you not like being around your kids? There's nothing greater than being home with your wife and your kids. That's the most beautiful thing.
Kids are a challenge. There's no doubt about that. Kids are a challenge, but they shouldn't be a burden.
They're not a burden.
They should be something that we should joyfully enter into every day and willfully sacrifice ourselves in love.
They're the greatest gift we've ever been given.
Yeah.
So we're going to skip a few of these because this is a teaser and you should go read the article by John Sr. It's not that long. It'll be very helpful, especially if you read through this because we left out a lot. And this will really give you the roadmap, the reason our society is so messed up. If you're not convinced, go read the article. It's on The Remnant. But we're going to talk about peace, finally. The 10th step is peace, which St. Thomas says means not to be disturbed. It is achieved, he says, by fixing our desires upon a single object, not restlessly wishing upon a dozens of others at the same time. Many a man is faithful to his wife in not desiring other women, but is not at peace with her because his heart is on the business of a football game or writing a book or working. Peace is making his wife the apple of his eye. If there is music, sing it just for her. Celebrate the dinner which she cooked in praise of her. Peace is singleness of purpose, such as servants have, whose eyes are always on their master's hands. If we practice peace, we shall arrive at the penultimate step, joy. And so that's peace. To think about your wife, to want to be with her, not to constantly be thinking about how you make more bread, how you bring it home the bacon.
Yeah.
About the next thing that you're going to do, about what you're going to do tonight. It's thinking about her that drives us home. Or you want to spend time with her. This is the passion that should help us not to sit in front of the TV, but to sing to our wives, to write her poetry, to love her. Our society doesn't love anymore.
No,
not really. Society is too distracted to love.
Well, yeah, it's like we said here, you know, fixing our desires upon a single object, not restlessly wishing upon a dozen others at the same time. And especially in today's world with the phone, the TV, all of it is just, you know, crying out for your attention. But being at peace with just gazing upon your wife or talking to her or simply just looking at her and just being there with her. And I was reading about prayer today, and that's kind of the top rung of the so-called prayer ladder is prayers is really no longer a conversation. You just sit in the presence with the one that loves you, and you love them back. And that's just, we should try to emulate that in our homes. We should get to the point where we have enough peace. Where simply sitting with our wives and sitting with our family is more than enough to make us happy.
But you do have to walk up the steps first, just mm-hmm. like in prayer. You can't just go to prayer, close your eyes and go, Lord, I'm in front of you and you're in front of me and then expect to be at the top. You got to take each rung step by step before you can arrive at that union. And so the way that we build those steps is like what John Sr. was saying here. And he says that the practice of joy, he mentioned joy, is praise. and so there must be music in the home. Not in the stereo, no matter how good, but as the old Irish tenor John McCormick used to sing in his most famous song about a man whose wife had died. And all the ringing gladness of your voice, the words that made my lonely heart rejoice, you spoke, do you remember? All my heart still hears the distant music of your voice. You have to sing and play instruments yourself and read poetry aloud and really enjoy it. Yes, husbands and wives must do these things if they are to be friends together. Taking music now in the wide sense of anything artistic, tender, beautiful, and sweet, it is a message sent to one you love, like a splendid cherry pie or a freshly ironed shirt. One last thought. You could make an honest complaint about all of this. These are really just pious platitudes and none relates in any way to our actual marriages. Few of us will find this famous love, joy, and peace, at least not for very long. Well, if it is true that love is happiness, then we always seem to fail. But I have something for your consolation. Do you remember on the birthday or the wedding, just when you cut the cake? That is really the best moment. The eating always seems sort of a letdown. You expect who knows what, and it was just cake. Love is not just cake. It is the moment just before. That's the mystery of it. Because all love is a waiting for something we don't even know about yet. Especially the love of husbands and wives will always be a yearning and a sigh. This isn't an argument. Perhaps you can take it as a thought to cheer your heart.
Never forget, we were made for the stars, planted in the soil.